commencing countdown.
3, 2, 1.
This is the Contracting Experience. Connecting government contracting professionals to the world around them through conversations with acquisition influencers, insights into evolving hot topics, and sharing lessons learned from the field.
Welcome, podcast listeners. On this episode of The Contracting Experience, we sit down with Captain Ariel Parker and Senior Master Sergeant Ryan Ledford, who are Air Force contracting professionals having just completed their fellowships in the Education with Industry, or EWI, program. Captain Parker and Senior Ledford share their experiences working with a startup company and a nonprofit tech accelerator. They each discuss what they found impactful during their EWI fellowships, as well as how contracting professionals can start applying their lessons learned today. Welcome, Captain Parker and Senior Ledford. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm happy to be here, Senior Ledford. Excited to share my experience and learn also from what Captain Parker has to offer too. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Rob, for having us. I'm beyond excited to be a part of this podcast, and I'm looking forward to our discussion today.
All right, excellent. Yeah, welcome to you both. I'm really grateful for you taking the time here after your fellowships. I'm sure you're anxious to get back to your offices and apply some of these lessons learned. So I'm looking forward to diving in and hearing about each of your experiences with EWI. But to set the stage for our listeners that might not be familiar with the program, can you tell us a little bit about Education with Industry, or affectionately known as EWI? Captain Parker, why don't you lead us off, and then Senior Ledford can fill in any gaps.
Yes, of course. So the Education with Industry program, it's a 10-month program. You apply through the AAD speed guide will come out. And in there, it details all about the EWI program, how to apply. It's really exciting, and it works very similar to like a dream sheet. So you get to submit for a couple of companies. The program team will take into consideration what companies you want to work for. One thing I found super interesting is if there's a company that you want to work for, but it isn't on the EWI list, not a problem. You can actually chat with the program managers and try to get that company in the program for the next year. So we actually did have a contracting EWI fellow do that this year. And I'll hand it over to you, Senior Ledford. What am I missing?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I'll give a perspective from the enlisted side. So it's very similar to the officer side, and as far as applying, and the program runs succinctly. You're in lockstep with the officers as they go into their companies. The enlisted side is a little different when you apply. It's actually open potentially right now, depending on when this airs, and it closes here very soon. And there's a application process through MyVector. And you answer a handful of questions and tell the board essentially who then looks at your answers and decides based on what the numbers are for your career field. And so for the enlisted side, there's not a ton of openings. Usually, at least in contracting, it's like one, maybe two per year. And so to be competitive, highlight yourself and identify the things that you think the Air Force wants to learn about, and then let them tell you no at the end of the day.
All right, excellent. And I believe it's open to our civilian workforce as well, correct?
Yes, that's true. We actually had two civilian EWI fellows with us this year.
All right, excellent. And again, just the fact that it being extremely competitive like it is, and there's very few slots available. Again, congratulations to you both for being, picked for this opportunity to begin with. So that's awesome. All right, so thanks for providing the background and the insight, right? Some of the inner workings of the program. But now let's get kind of into the nitty gritty, if you will. What did each of you work on during your time in EWI? And what have you learned that you can share with us? Just a few thousand of your closest contracting colleagues here on the podcast. So Senior Ledford, let's start off with you on this one. What company did you work for? And what were your roles, responsibilities, and maybe any special projects you worked?
Yes, great. Thank you. The company I was a part of, it's a nonprofit. It's called Catalyst Campus for Technology and Innovation. They are located in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And it was an amazing year in Colorado Springs. I love Colorado. And I really had the opportunity to experience what a downtown feel is. And so the organization, CCTI for short, is on the east side of Colorado Springs, and they function in a tech innovation, tech acceleration environment. And so what they do is they have government partners that have problem sets. They will find those problem sets, and then they will identify potentially small businesses, even large businesses in the area that match up fairly well with those problem sets. They'll bring them together in various collaboration events and exercises. They will work through some problem sets. They'll collaborate, they'll bring other people in. And then hopefully at the end of the day, they provide a solution, or at least potentially a minimal viable product, MVP type idea, back to the government so they can take that and run with it. Maybe get a contract down the road with somebody else, but really Calis Campus is the generator and accelerator of some of these problem sets and solutions that that the government has what they face. And one of the things, or at least a couple of the things that I worked in and with the company, is I was really invested in the strategic and operational aspects of what CCTI does. And so my main goal was to sit down with whoever was in charge. And I found out that there was a senior executive director of CCTI. And so her and I basically said, hey, let's look at what your role can be here as a, you know, recently promoted senior master sergeant and someone that was going to go on a staff post, post EWE. How can I best use the time that I have with this company? What kind of things do they do that I could translate back to the Air Force? And so I sat in a ton of briefings with her, you know, with the board that they work with as a nonprofit, but also down into who they want to work with, you know, downstream companies. And so I really got to see the inner workings of how it would manage and operate and run a nonprofit. How does it look from the industry side to work with the government? And so my eyes were very opened, I can say the least, on how industry perceives government interactions and such. And so, yeah, so I did a lot of engagement with the director, and I basically shadowed her and was in a lot of quite interesting briefs. And I was able to look at a lot of their portfolio as well on the contracting side. They do almost all agreements, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But it was fascinating to see how they function and operate in this very fast-paced world. Thank you.
All right, very cool. Thanks, Senior Lidford. Captain Parker, same questions. What company did you work for, and what were your roles and responsibilities?
So I worked with Andrew Industries out in Costa Mesa, California. For those of you who don't know, I think Andrew's actually a pretty big name now, but they're a defense, I would say, software and technology company, and they focused really on, I would say, surveillance solutions. So they have a wide range of products. We're talking about autonomous drones, AUVs, so underwater vehicles, sensors, and then kind of the centerfold of all of their products is Lattice, which is a C2 platform. So really all of their products together are designed to help us have better situational awareness. And it's just a lot of things going on at their company right now, which made it super exciting for me to be there. I worked with their legal team, and their legal team actually is broader than what you would think in the traditional sense of, you know, most people just think lawyers. That's not Andrew's legal team. It's lawyers, it's contracts managers, it's their legal operations staff, it's the proposal team. So for me, it was really fitting because I got to stay really close to that contracting side of the house. And it gave me the opportunity to dip my toes into a lot of things. So I was working with their operations staff to implement a contract management system. I was reviewing NDAs and agreements with other commercial companies. I was looking into different contract vehicles for the company to take advantage of, like GSA schedules. And one thing that I will highlight about the EWE program is that you get to be an advocate for yourself. So like I said, it was nice that I got to stay so close to the contracting realm, but I did have other opportunities to branch out within the company and go on, I'm going to call them side quests, with their mission operations team. So I actually got to go help train customers go to conferences where they're actually trying to interact with customers, figure out how to make their products better, even sell their products in that sense. So it was a really, really amazing opportunity to just, as Senior Lefford said, see things from the other side.
All right. Excellent. Yeah, no, that, both of those sound like excellent opportunities. And again, very few people get those opportunities. So appreciate you guys sharing your experiences there. Some of us just have that, like myself, that government career for 30, 40 years, and we deal with industry, but we really don't understand, you know, how we could maybe work with them better or get that inside scoop, if you will. So let's switch gears a little bit. So now that you've gotten a glimpse from kind of both sides of the aisle, so to speak, how does industry learn to work with government and keep up to date with all these ever-changing, ever-evolving regulations? Captain Parker, why don't you start off on this one?
So the first thing I'm going to say here is that industry definitely puts their time in with the FAR and the DFARs and the DAFARs, just like we do. So that's, you know, was kind of interesting to me. I figured they did, but when I say they're in the books, they are in the books. The other thing is they do a lot of professional training from consultants. They're looking at articles that are written by other legal firms. They're looking at agency training, so GSA trainings, anything like that. They're reaching out and trying to connect to so many different facets of the government and things that are being offered. From our perspective on the government side, I think sometimes we get so absorbed in what's immediately coming out just, you know, through the Department of the Air Force that we don't think to look at these other open source consultants, things that are published online to help us. So I thought that was just super interesting. You know, they have so many outlets to gain information.
All right. Yeah, very cool. And they're taking advantage of those outlets. That's awesome. Because I think a lot of times is we just take for granted how great our government teams are, particularly, you know, those policy folks and the what's new notices. And, you know, we're always up to date on the latest initiatives, the latest regulations and things like that. And a lot of times we don't realize, hey, is industry keeping up with the same pace? And it sounds like they definitely are. So Senior Lefford, did you experience the same sort of thing?
Very similar to what Captain Parker said. We, at least from my experience, I was able to see the company bring in some subject matter experts, and we had what we called lunch and learns. It's that kind of style of event. And this would allow a subject matter expert, whether it would be from outside the organization or if it was internal. And so I'll give a little nugget there as far as internal. So Catalyst Campus, the word is in the name, campus. It is an old rail station, or an old railway, basically depot in the middle of downtown Colorado Springs. This campus is huge. So it's a, more or less a historical building. They have office space throughout the building, whether it's a small one-person office or an office to fit four or five folks. And so we had partners on campus that had technical expertise that we would tap into to then share with the employees. And so I considered myself an employee at that point. So we received, you know, countless briefings, and I was able to be a part of some of those briefings as well, of providing some of the Air Force side of the house. But we received that information because the director wanted to continue to grow her employees so that we were more capable of interacting with the government, but also more competent in what we were talking about. So very similar to what Captain Parker said.
All right. Excellent. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And then how about this one? So keeping you on stage there, Senior Lefford, over the past several years, you kind of introduced this a little bit on the intro, but we've seen a growing popularity over the use of OTAs, right? That other transaction authority for both prototype as well as production. Based on your experiences with industry, how do they perceive these agreements? Are they receptive to this kind of new way of doing business?
So I'll give you a contracting answer. It depends. It depends on what it is. So I won't get into much of it, but I do know that depending on what you're doing, the contract type matters. It matters a lot. And if certain organizations in the Air Force aren't familiar with how to do certain contract types, they don't always do it perfect. And I don't expect everybody to do it perfect. But there are some times when you see some just difficult functions inside of agreements, whether it be the scope of it, the definition of it, the terms and conditions, the nuance of what an agreement is kind of inherent to the problem in some instances. So OTAs is very interesting. I mean, it's not widely accessible to everybody. People already know this, but only certain organizations can actually implement that. Air Force is one of them. But it's not used for everything. And it's purpose built for certain things. And so we need to have, and this is a plug, we need to have the organizations that do utilize OTAs really look at what the impact of the structure does to the commercial partner, whether it be a nonprofit, whether it be small business or a lab or whatever. How you structure it and how you communicate those things, that matters. It matters a lot. So it can be the right vehicle, but at times there are other ones that are better. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Great insight there. And yeah, perfectly understandable, right? Same thing goes with, just the contract type in general. Like you said, it's not a one size fits all. You know, it takes that thought process and that strategic viewpoint to say, hey, maybe an incentive contract works better. Maybe a non-FAR based instrument is the right fit. But you're absolutely right. We just can't throw something out there without understanding the intent behind that agreement. So yeah, thanks for that. How about you, Captain Parker? Have you witnessed the sort of the same thing with OTAs from industry?
Yes. I would say industry is definitely on top of OTAs. And I want to piggyback off of something that Senior Ledford said, actually, talking about the nuances and of the terms, of the definitions, and the things we're putting into OTAs. So we all know that the OTA is not FAR-based, and that kind of results in this little bit of a battle where we as a government are trying to put some FAR-esque terms in there. And, obviously the whole purpose of this is for industry to have a little bit of an easier way in, easier time understanding, is easier time complying with requirements. And so when we have that strain going on, it just creates a lot of tension in the partnership, and it gets confusing. So we know what certain terms mean within the FAR, but when we're taking that language out and, just ripping off the clause number and putting it into the OTA, now you have terms in there that don't necessarily have assigned definitions anymore. And that can get confusing not only for us, but for industry, because now we have two different ideas about what a certain term can mean. So yeah, I just think that's an excellent point that you brought up, Senior Ledford. And I think industry is receptive to OTAs and they want to do them, but we kind of all have to work together to figure out the best way to move forward with them and make sure that everyone on our side has the proper training and, skill set to move forward with them.
Right. Yeah, great point. And again, the key thing with that is design for flexibility, but our comfort zone for years and years has been that FAR, right? We like the clauses, we like the clarity, it's what we're used to. And again, we just have to know when you're dealing with an OTA, not forget everything you've known up to that point, but again, a lot of it you need to, shift the paradigm, if you will. So yeah, great points. So Captain Parker, let's stick with you for another one here. So along the same lines, do you have examples of specific challenges that industry encounters that maybe the government side might be less aware of?
For sure. So when I was with Anduril, they were actually experiencing this huge period of growth. And so with growth comes change. And in many of their NAICS codes, they were no longer a small business. But let's be honest, like when you just emerge out of that small business territory, you're not automatically a large business. You're kind of somewhere in that medium stage. So when you're that type of company, it can be really difficult to start implementing the changes that you need, like prepping for CAS compliance, getting engineers to log their time, onboarding all of these people to support projects and contracts that you've gotten. I think on the government side, we tend to lose focus of that because we're so worried about the contract, the deliverables. And, as long as things are going well on that end, we're happy. But, we can't forget that these are real companies dealing with internal change management. They're adjusting to new norms. It's difficult for them. There's a few other things. So sourcing, that was super interesting to me. So I had the opportunity to sit down with a few members of Anduril's sourcing team to look at how they vet suppliers. And I never realized that this was such an in-depth and complex process. So on the industry side, your sourcers and your engineers, they're not the same people. And the engineers, a lot of the times, they don't always have a background in government contracts. So they're used to being able to acquire things from different areas, you know, maybe areas that the government doesn't want us to acquire things from. So there's a lot of challenges in trying to make sure that we're ensuring that supply chain integrity. And, you know, from the government side, as long as the contractor's doing it right, we're happy. But I don't think it's something that we look at and understand intuitively how challenging it can be for them. And then the last thing I want to touch on is data rights. So, you know, looking behind the curtain on data rights, it's so fascinating to see why it's important to industry. So data rights, it's protection for their intellectual property and intellectual property that they're coming up with, you know, not always on the government dime. So it's only natural that they want to ensure this fair compensation for the investment that they're putting in to create the software, these products. So, you know, with the government, I think we're seeking that transparency, accountability. We're trying to avoid things like vendor lock. You look at these two things, and those are both the industry perspective and the government perspective. They're both very valid, but at times can be competing interests. So I definitely get, you know, now having both perspectives, how it can be really difficult to reconcile data rights in a manner that's going to be satisfactory to both parties.
Wow. Yeah. Great points there. And I can certainly see those issues being a challenge, you know, especially with data rights in today's environment. And I think that's why we're also seeing a trend in that negotiation, the way we handle the negotiations, right? More of a collaborative approach. Hey, what do we really need out of it? Do you really need all the data rights? You know, do you want to pay for all the data rights? How about you only pay for what you need? You know, things like that. And I think it's kind of changed our stance on negotiations over the years, is that we're no longer focused on that bottom line. We're looking for areas. Okay, what's really, you know, the driving points of each side? You know, maybe we can all get what we're looking for, right? The ideal negotiation. So yeah, right. That open communication and collaboration and data rights is certainly at the forefront of that, right? If we just say, nope, I want the data rights and just treat it as a yes, no, did I get them or not? Well, there's a whole lot of variation in there and flexibility and all different kinds. So I, you know, there should be certainly room in that negotiation where both sides can get what they're truly looking for. So how about you, Senior? Have you witnessed any other specific challenges that industry encounters that we, the government side, may not be fully aware of or fully appreciate?
That's a great question. And Captain Parker, you crushed that question, by the way. You hit the nail on the head. Data rights is huge. And as when I was working with Calus Campus, since they're a nonprofit and they facilitate integration of technology and stuff, They hold partnership intermediary agreements and other cooperative agreements. And so they function as kind of this middleman, more or less, to help integrate this technology. And so as this integrator, they have a stance, at least it is in this point, it's pretty open. They have a stance on they're not going to take IP. So that the benefit, to Kevin Parker's point, the benefit back to that small business that has this data right intellectual property that is their bread and butter, is the like center of gravity for that company, they can retain it when they work with the government. And then on the backside, if they do end up getting a contract, they can then work on that piece, but they don't have to get rid of their company, more or less, during the kind of the testing practice phase. So that was very interesting to see. And then the other side is just simply a nonprofit operates very interesting. They still have to maintain a budget. They still have to maintain a profitable business. So that's one thing that I knew going into it, like, hey, I know a nonprofit, they're not supposed to make profit, quote unquote, but they still have to have revenue. They have to pay their people. You can't just get grants only. They have to have contracts to facilitate those things as well. So this, seeing that nuance and that that dance, more or less, with how you navigate like shared spaces, but also how you navigate, you know, getting a subject matter expert to work on, you know, this contract, it is very interesting. And I don't think the government realizes how difficult it is to maintain entities like this. And there's a ton of them across the country. And it's difficult. They're on thin margins, and they're working as hard as they can to serve the government machine. And it'd be nice to have more of a insight into that. And so that's what I actually received, a little bit more insight into how they operate.
Okay, yeah, that's a great point. Because a lot of time we think nonprofit, and like you said, that doesn't mean non-revenue, right? They're still getting entitled to get paid for their services, certainly. But the nonprofit, you know, they just reinvest that back in to the company. But yeah, that's a great insight, and I think maybe a lot of our listeners might understand. Yeah, nonprofit. Well, that don't get that confused with non-revenue, right? So a great point. Thanks for bringing that up. So let's kind of move on here. We'll keep the senior Ledford on stage here. So if you could adopt an industry practice from the company that you worked with and bring it over to the government side, what would you adopt?
Well, I can tell you what I would get rid of.
Okay.
I would get rid of,
fair enough.
Get rid of showing up to meetings super early. That's just a waste of time for everybody. Now, if you're briefing, you need to make sure you've got it all set up and you've practiced in the space. It's a good practice. Knowing the area and getting comfortable, sure. But if you're going to receive and you're in a meeting and you're receiving, there's no reason to be there 15 minutes early. It doesn't make any sense. So I don't know if it's going to disrupt the Air Force industry by saying that, but it needs to be said. There's no reason to show up super early. But something else too is, if you need a meeting, then have a meeting. But if you don't, then don't. So it's helpful to ask the question beforehand. Could this be an email? Could this be a one-on-one? Could this be a white paper, something? Or does it actually have to be a meeting? Is it value added to bring people in a room together, talk at them, and then leave? Probably not. But maybe the meeting can be collaborative. You have ideas, you send an agenda out beforehand and people can think through what it's going to be so they can have questions and collaborate in that space. So when we have meetings and when we not have meetings, that's something that I would definitely try to implement pretty quickly if I can.
All right. So you think I think that's kind of an age old dilemma, going back to basic training. You know, if you're not 15 minutes early or late, maybe a lot of us baby boomers are still carrying that around with us. And then meetings for the sake of meetings, right? That's something we kind of always struggle with. But have you seen, based on your experience, is industry actually better at that? Is that a government problem or what do you think?
I'll give another contracting answer. It depends on what it is. So sometimes I think the government can be good at it. We have specific meetings and collaboration instances where we work together to solve a problem and it makes sense, right? You have that medium for a reason. But I think on the industry side, they do it just on average better. If you don't need to be there, don't be there. Like, and if it doesn't need to be in person or via Zoom, then it doesn't need to be that way. And they're not afraid to cancel a meeting if it was on schedule, if it doesn't need to happen. Like calendar invites and calendar meetings that are scheduled every week, sometimes they don't need to happen. And they're not afraid to say, no, hey, we're good. Give your time back. If you have any questions, let me know. And I loved that. Because then you have time to do stuff. You have time to engage maybe with somebody that was in that meeting that you may not be able to engage with otherwise. So, I think on average, they probably do it better than the government.
All right. No, great. Great to know. And but before my email blows up, these are just perspectives. Right? Everyone probably has different experiences, both on the government and the industry side. So the big takeaway there is efficiency of meetings, efficiency of calendar usage, things like that. So yeah, very, very great point. Captain Parker, how about you? Did you see any best practices during your time with Anduril that you'd like to see adopted by the government?
For sure. And before I say them, I just want to double tap. Yes, meeting efficiency. And Anduril did that extremely well. They did 30-minute meetings and they always ended on time. So I think one that respects everyone's time, but it also incites people to show up prepared. Because if you know, like, hey, I've got, you know, 1300 to 1330 to have this conversation, you're going to show up ready. You're going to have that conversation. So I think it just does a ton. But as far as other practices that I would love to see adopted, the first one I'm going to say is a little bit of the adoption of informal, formal, widespread communication. So I think on the government side, we're getting better about this. So we have our TTPs. People are more willing to kind of interact informally through Teams. But what I really loved about Anduril was Slack. And Slack is just amazing. You have all of these channels. And on the industry side with Anduril, they had different channels for different business lines. So even though I wasn't necessarily a part of one business line, I was still able to go peek into their channel and see the going on, the top news, what's happening with that team to keep me more, I would say, knowledgeable about the company as a whole. And so I understand from the government side, we can't necessarily do that with all of our programs, but wouldn't it be great to just have a little bit more insight into, hey, what is, you know, SSC have going on in regards to this type of thing? What does, you know, Yokota versus Misawa doing on this type of thing? So it'd be great to see a little bit more of that free flow, widespread communication in a platform that's, I'm going to say, enticing for people to use, because I think that was another great thing about Slack is, I don't want to say it operates like social media, but between the different channels, it's a really easy platform to use. And that makes people use it. When it's easy, people use it. So definitely adopting informal, widespread communication methods. The other thing I would say is more on the people side. And this is something I really appreciated about my time at Anduril, but it was weekly one-on-ones with your immediate supervisor. For me, that was a weekly one-on-one with a particular lawyer. We covered down on my tasks that week, any questions I had, honestly, just the going ons of my life, how I was doing as a person. And I think, you know, in the churn of things, it's really easy to lose sight of the people. And this was something Anduril did that helped them keep that in focus. And similar to what we're talking about with efficiency, like your one-on-one, even though it's a scheduled time block every week, if it didn't need to happen, it didn't happen. If you had other priorities, obviously cancel it. But there's something really reassuring and great about knowing I have this specific time slot on my boss's calendar, on my supervisor's calendar, on my contracting officer's calendar to talk about specific issues or to talk about my personal life and my ambitions and things I want to do. Every week. So, you know, I think it's really helpful from that people perspective to help us not only take care of the mission, but take care of each other.
Yeah, that's very, very extremely well said. Yeah. And again, there's definitely that trend on communication, right? I think it comes up on almost every podcast. Something, you know, we have all these different avenues to communicate, but it seems like we're getting worse and worse at it, maybe because we're doing away with that face-to-face interaction that's so valuable. But anyway, you know, big emphasis on communication there. And again, not to put industry in one box and government in another box, right? We all just have to find the right communication mechanisms that fit for our teams, right?
Absolutely.
So this has been a great conversation. Again, I want to thank both of you for joining us on the Contracting Experience podcast. But before I let you go, I want to sort of put you on the spot here with one final question, and you can include any parting shots within your response that you'd like to make. So here's a challenge for both of you. We kind of identified some areas where the government may not be fully in tune or things the government could possibly do better when compared with industry. So now that you're familiar with both sides of the government acquisition process and have some insight into the secret sauce of both government and industry, how are you going to be an agent of change to improve some of these challenges and incorporate these lessons learned into your respective organizations? Senior Ledford, we'll give you the first shot at this one. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you. So that's,
and we are being recorded. So
yes, I know. These are my opinions.
You are on record here for this commitment. So make it a good one.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is the opinion of Ryan Ledford and not the Air Force, but three things that I wrote down in my briefings and then communicated as much as I could to as many people as I could. There are three things. So one, what are your priorities? What are the Air Force priorities? What is the organization's priorities? What are the mission partner priorities? But also, as important, what are industry's priorities? What is this government contractor's priorities? And why do they do what they do? So understanding what those things are and going into a negotiation, going into RFP or whatever the scenario is, going into that, knowing what it is that you're, what you care about and what matters, that's important. And so that's important because if you stray from those maybe bottom line items, then you're potentially harming your own organization if you don't stick to what those priorities are. And the second thing of the three is communication, hitting on it again, like Captain Parker said, but communicating what those priorities are. And not only what priorities are, but also communicating expectations. So if you don't know what you expect from the government, upside, if you don't know what you expect from your industry partner, you're starting off on the wrong foot. And if you continue, hopefully you continue to communicate those things throughout the process, that's going to just build that relationship up. That's going to continue to build off of that foundation of trust. And hopefully that leads to a win-win-win, and it's not a lose-lose or a win-lose situation. So that's important. And then the last thing I'll leave you with, and this is definitely one of the things I saw from a nonprofit side, was prompt payments. I can't tell you how important the dollar is. I can't tell you how important having a payment received on time matters, especially to a organization that is running off of grants and donations and all of that. So if we, and it doesn't just happen to nonprofits, but it happens to everybody. If we as a government can put as a priority, we need to pay these people on time. And if we can pay them a little early, maybe there's a 15 incentive, we can pay people on time and or early. That's going to help them, the contractor, that's going to incentivize them to maybe do a little bit more than they thought they could do, or at a minimum, do exactly what they told us we were going to do in a comfortable way, paying their people on time so they can have a life and a living, and they can be incentivized also to continue to do the good work that they're doing. So, yep, top three things: priorities, communication, prompt payments, and I'll mic drop on that one.
All right. Yeah, great points, Senior Ledford. Remember, we're going to hold you accountable to implementing those things in your organization. So, yeah, thanks for that. And again, congratulations on your selection and completion of the EWE program. So that's awesome.
Thank you.
All right. Captain Parker, over to you. Tough act to follow there, but what's your strategy and commitment going back to your organization to help improve how we can operate in our relationships with industry?
Yeah, for sure. A tough act to follow there, Ryan. Come on. But I'm gonna attack this question, I think, from a little bit of a different angle. So all of the things I've talked about are things I want to implement. But one thing I want to say is you kind of have to start small. You can't boil the ocean. And so I've captured all these things that I think can help make our organization 2-3% better here and there. But I really think to be effective in implementing change, you have to start with your immediate surroundings. So that's what I intend to do. I want to go back to my office and start what I'm going to call like a little grassroots movement, make things better where we can. And this isn't just me. This is something I think all of us as contracting professionals have the ability to do. We have our own individual experiences, successes, losses, like things that we can bring to the table that if we start small in our immediate organizations and then allow those TTPs, those successes, those losses, that knowledge to proliferate throughout the organization, then we're going to be a much better force later on. So use your networks, use your immediate skills where you are right now, blue where you're planted. That's what I'm going to mic drop on.
All right. Excellent, Captain Parker. Another great approach. And again, I trust both of you will continue to spread your lessons learned throughout your education with industry experience. And again, the majority of your colleagues aren't going to ever have that experience. So Senior Ledford, as you know, a senior NCO, you're going to influence a lot more individuals during your career. So keep the pedal to the metal, if you will. Captain Parker is hopefully a future commander in the Air Force. Again, never forget these examples that you want to implement, because if you can't implement them today, and again, I totally get the boiling the ocean thing. You know, you can't read a book on Steve Jobs and show up on Monday with a black turtleneck thinking you're going to change the world. So I totally get that. So I definitely want to keep that in the framework. But again, you've got a lot of great ideas here, a lot of great observations from your experience. Don't let them sit on a shelf, right? Put those things, just encourage you both to implement those plans. So awesome. And again, thank you so much again for sharing your experiences and insights on The Contracting Experience. This has been a great conversation and I'm grateful you could both join us. So on behalf of The Contracting Experience podcast, all of our listeners and subscribers, thank you so much for joining us today. As always, it's been a pleasure having you. And thank you to all of our podcast listeners, followers, and subscribers. If you have any feedback, suggestions for topics, or future guests you would like to hear on the podcast, you can submit those via email to thecontractingexperience@gmail.com. As a reminder, you can subscribe to The Contracting Experience podcast from any of your podcast listening platforms. Be sure to subscribe to receive updates and automatic downloads so you don't miss a single episode. I'm your host, Rob Lorton, from the AFMC Contracting Digital Division, and I hope you can join us again on our upcoming episodes. Until then, stay tuned and stay connected.